your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The U.S. Senate has recently passed legislation authorizing a record $858 billion in annual defense spending, $45 billion more than proposed by President Joe Biden. This is while the GOP is blocking $12 billion to fight child poverty. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Common Dreams wrote in this regard, Congressional Republicans happily teamed up with Democrats to authorize $858 billion in military spending for the next fiscal year. But the GOP is refusing to even consider proposals to revive the child tax credit expansion that lifted millions of kids out of poverty last year, even though bringing the program back would cost a fraction of the Pentagon outlay. A spokesperson for Senate Finance Committee Chair Ron Wyden told Huffington Post earlier this week that Republicans have thus far been unwilling to negotiate over the child tax credit, CTC boost, which they unanimously opposed when it was enacted as part of the American Rescue Plan last year. Republicans have refused to engage at all on the child tax credit, said Ashley Shapdale. In fact, they made clear they would not negotiate on any deal that includes the child tax credit, she added. Leading Republicans readily confirmed their refusal to consider the CTC boost as part of an end-of-year tax package. With the 60-vote Senate filibuster intact, Democrats need the support of at least 10 Republicans to revive the expanded CTC in some form. As of right now, there is no support for that on the Republican side, Senator Mike Crapo, the top Republican on the Senate Finance Committee, told HuffPost. Republican Kevin Brady, one of 176 House Republicans who voted in favor of $858 billion National Defense Authorization Act last week, declared that the country frankly doesn't have the time or the money for the partisan, expensive provisions such as the child tax credit. The 2021 program, which expanded the existing CTC to include the poorest families and sent out payments of up to $3,600 per child in monthly increments, spared a historic drop in the obscenely high U.S. child poverty rate before it expired at the end of last year, thanks to Senator Joe Manchin and GOP opposition to extending the benefit. The boosted CTC's expiration has pushed millions of children back into poverty across the U.S. and caused a significant jump in hunger, heightening the sense of urgency among campaigners and many Democratic lawmakers seeking to reinstate the program. The expanded child tax credit reduced child poverty by more than 40%. It cut child hunger by a third. said the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Working-class families need this relief now, and Congress has a chance to bring it back before the end of the year. Progressives will keep fighting to get this done. In an attempt to jumpstart negotiations, Democrats have said they would be willing to entertain a slate of corporate tax cuts that the GOP wants to enact before the end of the year. But even the prospect of delivering another major windfall to large companies hasn't proved sufficiently enticing for Republicans to suspend their long-standing opposition to government anti-poverty programs. Congressional Democrats and the Biden White House have also suggested they would accept a more limited version of the 2021 CTC boost, potentially including more strict work requirements and other eligibility limits, which progressives oppose. Such concessions have apparently failed to sway Republicans. Following the lapse of the expanded program in December 2021, the CTC reverted back to its previous form, which includes smaller payments and a regressive phase-in that prevents the poorest families from obtaining the benefit. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, CBPP, estimates that eliminating the phase-in and allowing low-income families that are ineligible under current law to receive the full CTC benefit would cost roughly $12 billion a year. By comparison, the House and Senate voted this month to increase U.S. military spending by $90 billion over fiscal year 2022 levels. This isn't using our taxpayer dollars wisely. It's robbing programs that we need, like the discontinued child tax credit expansion that cut child poverty by half. Lindsay Kashagarian, director of the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, wrote in a recent blog post, adding, "The only winners here are military contractors who commandeer roughly half of the Pentagon's budget in any given year. Congress has until next week to approve a funding package to avert a government shutdown, meaning time is running out for a last-ditch CTC push." The stakes are massive. As CBPP noted earlier this month, without an expansion of the child tax credit and with the expiration of various other relief measures, child poverty is likely to return to about the same level as it was pre-pandemic, pushing millions of children back into poverty. Policymakers can expand the child tax credit or they can fail to act and see the rescue plan's historic gains against child poverty evaporate, the think tank warned. Senator Jeff Merkley said recently that he is fighting to get the expanded child tax credit passed before the end of the year. It reduced the child poverty and helped families make ends meet, the senator added, saying, "We must get it done."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United States and yet again, racially motivated killings happening on a record number. The tragic death of Keenan Darnell Anderson after he was tased by police officers in Los Angeles following a car accident has sparked outrage. Anderson, 31, cousin of the co-founder of the Black Lives Matter movement, Patrice Cullors, died at a hospital in Santa Monica, California, after suffering a cardiac arrest following the crash on the afternoon of January 3rd in a Los Angeles neighborhood. Anderson was repeatedly tased by Los Angeles police officers and restrained following the accident. In a 13-minute body cam footage released by Los Angeles Police Department, Anderson is seen begging for help as multiple officers hold him to the ground and one officer presses his elbow along with his body weight onto his neck.
You're trying to just
stop it. Stop it or I'm going to tase you. Okay, stop it or I'm going to tase you. Stop it or I'm going
to
tase you.
Then Anderson can be heard, "They're trying to George Floyd me," referring to African-American man George Floyd, who was killed at the hands of the U.S. police in May 2020 in Minneapolis, sparking racial justice protests around the world. In the footage, Anderson shouts, "They're trying to kill me," asking others for help. After the incident, paramedics arrived at the scene and took him to a hospital, where according to the police, he went into cardiac arrest, which caused his death. Now, Patrice Cullors, who herself co-founded the Black Lives Matter movement, says her cousin was asking for help and he didn't receive it. She said he was killed, adding that nobody deserves to die in fear, panicking and scared for their life. Cullors noted her cousin was scared for his life, stressing that he spent the last 10 years witnessing a movement challenging the killing of black people. He knew what was at stake and he was trying to protect himself. Nobody was willing to protect him. Anderson's killing is the third such incident linked to the Los Angeles police in the first days of 2023. On January 2nd, police fatally shot 45-year-old Tucker Smith, and a day after, police fired on a 35-year-old Oscar Sanchez. Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass has called the incidents deeply disturbing, adding that we must reduce the use of force overall, and I have absolutely no tolerance for excessive force. The latest police violence highlights alarming proportions in the U.S. in recent years, with people of color being the main targets. A 2021 study recorded 30,800 deaths from the police violence across the U.S. between 1980 and 2018, far higher than estimates offered by the National Vital Statistics System. The study said more than 55 deaths of such incidents in the U.S. from 1980 to 2018 were misclassified or unreported in official vital statistics reports. Meanwhile, according to new data released earlier this month, U.S. police killed at least 1,176 people in 2022, making it the deadliest year on record for police violence in the country since experts first started tracking the killings. The killing of Keenan Darnell Anderson takes numerous matters into the spotlight. First and foremost is how U.S. officials reacted to the incident. 31-year-old father and English teacher, who is an African-American, killed by LAPD police. The cause, cardiac arrest after being repeatedly tased by the police. Anderson is the cousin of Black Lives Matter movement Patrice Cullors, but still no major word or reaction from anyone within the establishment. Two, could this death by any means be prevented? Cullors say this was a traffic accident. Instead of treating Anderson like a potential criminal, police could have called the ambulance. If there was a policy in which traffic stops were met with unarmed professionals who come to the scene to help with whatever situation has happened, that would have prevented my cousin's death, and that would have prevented so many other deaths. The other matter that has to be taken into account is how he was killed. One officer had his elbow on Anderson's neck while he was lying down before another tased him for roughly 30 seconds straight before pausing and tasing him again for 5 more seconds. The other point is LAPD not calling it a killing. It instead calls it an in-custody death. Apart from the ambiguity of the phrase, Keen was tased to death. Everyone knows LAPD caused Keenan's death. Cullors say these types of killing and this type of force will not be interrupted unless we have courageous elected officials come forward and challenge not just the police, but also the policies. One other factor is that the incident marks the third officer-involved death in the city this year. From 1980 to 2018, more than 30,000 people have died by police violence in the United States, according to a 22 article published in The Lancet. U.S. police killing 3 people a day, and no progress since George Floyd. Based on figures released by Mapping Police Violence, police have killed roughly 1,100 people each year since 2013. In 2021, officers killed 1,136 people, one of the deadliest years on record. National data has shown that roughly 10% of the killings by police each year starts with a traffic encounter, and that 1 in 3 people killed were fleeing before lethal force was used. What about police brutality and racial bias? Why are there more cases of police brutality against African Americans or people of color than whites? By one estimate, black people are 2.5 times more likely than white men to be killed by police during their lifetime. In another study, black people who were fatally shot by police seem to be twice as likely as white people to be unarmed. Based on information from more than 2 million 911 calls in 2 U.S. cities, it can be concluded that white officers dispatched to black neighborhoods fired their guns 5 times as often as black officers dispatched for similar calls to the same neighborhoods. The Washington Post reports lawsuits to settle allegations of misconduct by more than 7,600 officers from around the country have amounted to more than $3.2 billion over the past decade. All in all, what seems to be a very high urgency is that U.S. police treatment of African Americans needs an overhaul. If not, more and more people like Keenan Darnell Anderson will fall victim to the U.S. police brutality, and officers involved killing will be sharply on the rise.
The Oxfam report analyzed 1,727 attacks on Yemeni civilians since the start of 2021. The report finds that at least 839 civilians were killed and 1,775 others were wounded during this time. 87 of the deaths were caused by airstrikes alone. The aircrafts used in the attacks, over half of them British-made, used cluster bombs, the use of which is banned by international law. The rest of the killings were done through artillery strikes, missile barrages, drone attacks, landmines, road bombs, and the use of light arms. According to another report by an American think tank, The American Thinker, Saudi Arabia spends some $200 million per day on the war to hire mercenaries and maintain the arms supply. A large portion of this money goes to the UK for purchasing Typhoon and Tornado aircrafts, Paveway bombs and Brimstone and Storm Shadow missiles, making the UK fully complicit in the crimes committed against Yemeni civilians. As stated by the International Development Committee of the UK, given that the UK has a long history of defense exports to Saudi Arabia and its coalition partners, and considering the evidence we have heard, it seems inevitable that any violations of international humanitarian and human rights law by the coalition have involved arms supplied from the UK. These arms have also been used by the Saudi-led coalition to bomb health facilities on 19 separate instances, which constitutes war crimes. Oxfam's policy advisor Martin Butcher called on the UK government to immediately cease its arms sales to the Saudis. He also pointed out the hypocrisy of UK sanctions against Russia over alleged war crimes in Ukraine, all the while turning a blind eye to the blatant war crimes of the Saudi coalition in Yemen. Not only that, but he also pointed out to the fact that the UK government still continues to sell arms to Saudi Arabia, being its second biggest arms supplier, which will be inevitably used in the war against Yemen. Butcher also said they, the government, have really been not only arming Saudi Arabia, but also very reluctant to use their position in the Security Council to push for peace. Saudi Arabia is the biggest importer of arms in the world, second only to a country with 40 times the population. In the year 2020 alone, the kingdom imported nearly $1 billion worth of arms, the majority of which came from the U.S. This, however, does not stop the U.S. from parroting a tired narrative of pushing for peace in Yemen when they even hesitate to call it a war. This is apparent by Biden's initial pledges to end the war during his presidential campaign while still supplying arms to the kingdom to this day. Here's Timothy Lender King, U.S. Special Envoy to Yemen.
Let me begin first by reiterating our commitment, the commitment of the United States, to helping improve Yemeni lives, creating the space for Yemenis to collectively determine their own future, and to advance a durable resolution that ends the conflict in Yemen.
All the while, the weapon fragments bearing U.S. and U.K. branding paints a starkly different picture. The 6 months UN-sponsored truce that was supposed to be the grounds for longer-standing solutions was also very quickly and repeatedly violated by Saudi Arabia. This is what Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement sees as the reason for the temporary truce. The Saudi-led coalition's main goal out of the truce was to stop the Houthi Ansarullah forces from carrying out retaliatory military operations against targets deep inside Saudi Arabia. Moreover, the crippling sea, land, and air blockade on Yemen has created a humanitarian disaster in the country. With all options exhausted, the Ansarullah movement has now said that it will inevitably launch missile strikes deep inside Saudi and UAE territories. This comes amid reports that the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is looking to find a way out of the incredibly costly Yemen war. The Lebanese Al-Akhbar newspaper wrote, "Riyadh is now showing a lot of flexibility during negotiations. It currently has no concern other than getting security guarantees that strategic facilities deep inside the country would not be hit. It has abandoned the illusion of turning Yemen into a country under its tutelage and has instead sufficed for security assurances." However, this report needs more confirmation. While the Saudi coalition has indeed failed in its attempts to strangle Yemen into submission, their aggression still caused what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen.
Since the war broke out in Ukraine and Western countries rushed to help Ukraine against Russia, they provided Ukraine with different types of weapons in a bid to prevent Russia's rapid military advance. But it has now turned out that the war has been a unique opportunity for Western arms manufacturers to make a profit. According to a report based on data from the Defense News and TradingView Analytics, major Western arms manufacturers involved in military supplies to Ukraine earned $124 billion last year. According to estimates, the corporation's combined market capitalization increased from $579 billion in December 2021 to $703 billion in December 2022. The ranking included 25 companies with a capitalization of over $1 billion, which are traded on the stock market and have military products dominating their revenues. These companies are actively involved in arms supplies to Ukraine. German arms manufacturer Rheinmetall has been the top gainer over the last 12 months. Its share price has surged 122%. Another notable example is French drone and missile producer Thales, whose stock value rose by 54%. American military contractor Northrop Grumman was up 44%, and the stock of HIMARS rocket launchers maker Lockheed Martin gained 42%. Other notable mentions in the report include BAE Systems, Kongsberg, Gruppen, General Dynamics, and Raytheon Technologies.
Rather than continuing to build up offensive capability by transferring weapons from the American side to the Ukrainian side, which enriches American defense contractors and only allows more Ukrainians and more Russians to bleed, more and more weapons will eventually lead to an escalation of the war, and that is extremely dangerous.
The report comes amid increasing military support for Ukraine. In 2022, the Biden administration committed more than $19 billion in military aid to Ukraine. It's set to give Ukraine another $45 billion in 2023. Washington is now seeking to deliver Patriot missile systems to Ukraine. The U.S. is now set to train scores of Ukrainian troops in how to deploy and maintain the American Patriot missile systems.
The training will prepare approximately 90 to 100 Ukrainian soldiers to operate, maintain, and sustain the defensive system over a training course expected to last several months. And once fielded, the Patriot will continue to contribute to Ukraine's air defense capabilities and provide another capability to the Ukrainian people to defend themselves against Russia's ongoing aerial assaults.
The Kremlin has said the systems and any crews accompanying them would be legitimate priority targets for the Russian military. The U.S. is now contemplating delivering Stryker armored vehicles to Ukraine as part of a new Pentagon shipment. Furthermore, the U.K. announced that it would provide Ukraine with main battle tanks, and Poland said it would transfer a company of Leopard 2 Panzers to Kiev. Germany has, however, to greenlight Poland's re-export of the hardware. Germany says it will follow the U.S. President Joe Biden's lead on whether to support Kiev with Leopard 2 main battle tanks. Germany has faced mounting pressure to provide Ukraine with Leopard 2 tanks, but has been reluctant to do so. Russia has repeatedly warned Western countries against sending arms to Ukraine. Russia has repeatedly warned the West against flooding Ukraine with weapons. It insists that sending more weapons to Ukraine will only prolong the war, while prompting the Kiev forces to kill civilians in the pro-Moscow regions.
Police in Brazil have detained some 1,500 supporters of former President Jair Bolsonaro over attacks on government buildings at the weekend, as calls for justice and accountability grow across the South American nation. Most of the former far-right leader's backers were detained when law enforcement forces dismantled a protest camp in the capital, Brasilia, which many demonstrators set off from on Sunday before breaking into Congress, the Supreme Court, and the presidential palace. The administration of Brazil's new left-wing president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who was officially sworn in on January 1st, has pledged to investigate those behind the violence and hold them to account. Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes, who is running investigations of the anti-democratic protests, vowed in a speech on Tuesday to combat what he called the terrorists at work in Brasilia. Rioters broke windows, toppled furniture, and hurled computers and printers to the ground as they ransacked the government buildings on Sunday. They destroyed precious works of art, overturned the U-shaped table where Supreme Court justices convene, ripped a door off one justice's office, and vandalized a statue outside the court. Lula denounced what he called far-right acts of terrorism as he met the leaders of both houses of Congress and the head of the Supreme Court. He had also blamed Bolsonaro for instigating his supporters after a campaign of baseless allegations about the October election results. Lula has vowed to bring to justice those responsible for what he called the fascist assault and declared federal intervention in public security in the capital lasting until January 31st. The riot came after Lula, who previously served as Brazil's president from 2003 to 2010, narrowly defeated Bolsonaro in a hard-fought presidential election runoff on October 30th. Bolsonaro is a former army captain who has expressed admiration for the military regime that ruled Brazil from 1964 to 1985. For months, he had falsely claimed the country's electronic voting system was vulnerable to fraud. Sunday's riot in Brasilia also drew parallels to the January 6, 2021 riot at the U.S. Capitol, which saw a mob of former President Donald Trump's supporters storm the legislature in an effort to stop Congress from certifying his successor Joe Biden's election victory. Brazilian police were noticeably slow to react to the riot in Brasilia, even after the arrival of more than 100 buses, leading many to question whether authorities had either simply ignored numerous warnings, underestimated the protesters' strength, or been somehow complicit. Prosecutors in the capital said local security forces were negligent at the very least. In Brazil's capital on Sunday, thousands of protesters attacked government institutions in a dangerous echo of the United States' January 6 insurrection. Bolsonaro, dubbed as Tropical Trump, has questioned the credibility of the country's electronic voting system without providing evidence. Lula was sworn in on January 1st. unleashing a barrage of rebuke against Bolsonaro for what he called his predecessor's mishandling of Brazil's affairs during his mandate. There have been claims of the CIA involvement in what is seen as a failed coup in Brazil. If true, why would the CIA attempt to do so? To be sure, the CIA does have a long track record of staging coups in Latin America, but it has done so with the intent of dismantling leftist governments and installing far-right regimes. Brazil is set to reassert itself in global geopolitics alongside fellow BRICS states Russia, India, and China. Lula at the helm in Brazil, in what is now his third non-successive presidential term, will offer a tremendous boost to BRICS. In the 2000s, Lula was a key conceptualizer of a deeper role for BRICS, including trade in their own currencies. The U.S. is being slowly but surely expelled from wider Eurasia by concerted actions of the Russia-China strategic partnership. Ukraine is a black hole, where NATO faces a humiliation similar to what the U.S. faced in Afghanistan, a feeble EU being forced by Washington to deindustrialize and buy U.S. liquefied natural gas at absurdly high cost as no essential resources for the empire to plunder. Geoeconomically, that leaves the U.S.-denominated Western Hemisphere, especially immense energy-rich Venezuela, as the key target. And geopolitically, the key region actor is Brazil. The U.S. would seemingly try to pull all stops to prevent Chinese and Russian trade expansion and political influence in Latin America, which Washington, irrespective of international law and the concept of sovereignty, continues to call its backyard.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we talked about Imam Khomeini's view on women and their status and role in family and society. In this episode, we are going to dwell upon the participation of some members of Imam Khomeini's family in the battlefronts during the 8-year imposed war in 1980s. Stay tuned, please. Sayyid Hassan Khomeini, grandson of Imam Khomeini and son of late Haj Ahmad Agha, was one of the members of the Imam's family who rushed to the front to take part in the nationwide struggle against the invading Saddam army. In 1987, he was studying at high school. At first, some of the family members didn't agree with Sayyid Hassan's going to the front. The reason for their disagreement was that, in case of Sayyid Hassan's captivity by the Iraqi military, it would demoralize the combatants. Fatemeh Tabatabai, wife of Ahmad Agha, says on the issue, "When our son was 13, Ahmad told him to go to the front. I told him that he was too young, but Ahmad told Hassan, Look, dear Hassan, perhaps you think why I myself don't go to the front. My body and spirit is in the front, but I think that presently taking care of the Imam is a greater obligation for me than going to the front. Imam Khomeini's daughter-in-law continues, Ahmad started to talk about the benefits of going to the front. He said, Now I tell you something, but all these things will finish tomorrow. This divine mercy will not be there forever so that you can benefit from it. Now it is the best opportunity to go to the war fronts and use this situation. I say these things so that later on you may not tell me, Daddy, I was not mature, but why didn't you tell me? All the better if you are martyred, but that will be good even if you are injured. However, you should try not to be captivated because it will cause many problems. The words of father affected the son, and the latter left for the front as a teenager. He was in the battlefront for a few months. Hujjat al-Islam Masih Burujerdi was another grandson of Imam Khomeini who participated in the war fronts in 1980s. He was sent to Khatam al-Anbiya base, but no one had noticed his relation with Imam Khomeini due to his family name. In fact, he was the son of one of Imam's daughters. Masih Burujerdi preferred to be unknown. Dr. Rajai from the Imam's office was in the front in those days and was aware of the issue. He relates, At that time, no one from the combatants and commanders of war noticed that this Basiji student who performs the congregational prayers quietly and anonymously was the Imam's grandson, Masih Burujerdi. When this young grandson of Imam Khomeini was about to leave for the front, some of the relatives went to the Imam's wife to dissuade him. Ms. Khadija Saghafi told them, You pray for all combatants, including our Masih. Pray for him to be a useful person in the front and return with health. Thus, Masih left for the front and came back after a while with health. Majid Qaravi was Ms. Saghafi's nephew who was martyred during Karbala 5 operation in Shalamche front. Majid had finished high school in 1983 and started studying in urbanization field at Mashhad University. He went to the battle fronts in 1986. At first, he was injured during the operation for liberation of Mehran city. After relative healing in Tehran, he left for the front again and attained the elixir of martyrdom in the epic Karbala 5 operation. He was very effective in persuading his friends and classmates to go to the front. He had told his friends at the university, Our studying is for God's satisfaction. And now God is more satisfied if we go to the front. In his last will, Majid had asked his mother to intercede for him on the Day of Judgment. When the Imam's wife read his last will, she told her sister, Majid's mother, with tears in her eyes, It is he who should intercede for you and us. No doubt, these pure and humble youths safeguarded Iran and the Islamic Revolution against enemies and turned Iran into a great power in the region and the world. We plead God for exaltation of their degrees in paradise and helping us follow their path. Amen.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women as human beings are completely equal in Islam. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on January 4, 2023. There is a verse in the Holy Quran that states, Indeed, the Muslim men and the Muslim women, the faithful men and the faithful women, the obedient men and the obedient women, the truthful men and the truthful women, the patient men and the patient women, humble men and the humble women, the charitable men and the charitable women, the men who fast, and the women who fast, the men who guard their private parts, and the women who guard, the men who remember Allah greatly, and the women who remember Allah greatly. Allah holds in store for them forgiveness and a great reward. The Holy Quran, chapter 33, ayah 35. This is Islam's view.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Or another ayah, God states, I do not waste the work of any worker among you, whether male or female. The Holy Quran, chapter 3, ayah 195. There is no difference between them. That is, there is no difference between men and women in terms of human and Islamic values. Islam views men and women as human beings. Neither one is more favored than the other. Of course, the duties of men and women are different. But there is a balance. There is a holy law mentioned in the Quran in Surah Al-Baqarah that states, And women have a right similar to those of men over them, in accordance with Islamic law. This is mentioned in the Holy Quran, chapter 2, ayah 228. They have the same number of rights over men as men have rights over them. Something belongs to them, and proportionately something else belongs to the other party, which is their duty and responsibility. So when a duty is assigned to someone, they have a right in return for it. For every privilege that is given to the either side, there is a responsibility. There is a complete balance that is about the rights of men and women. Therefore, they do not have the same rights and duties, but it is balanced.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. You've done for
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump has recently faced many charges and lawsuits in the U.S. courts of law. The charges against him are related to both his political and his economic activities. We take a look at the World Press and Media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Reuters news agency has covered this story and tells us more. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's real estate company has been sentenced to pay a maximum of $1.61 million criminal penalty after it was convicted of plotting to defraud tax authorities for 15 years. Justice Juan Merchan of the Manhattan Criminal Court in New York on Friday, 13th of January, imposed the sentence after jurors recently found two Trump Organization affiliates guilty of 17 criminal charges. On Tuesday, 10th of January, a longtime senior executive at Donald Trump's family business was sentenced to 5 months in prison on charges of fraud and tax evasion. Alan Weisselberg, a longtime friend of Donald Trump, who has served as the chief financial officer of the Trump Organization for the past 40 years, was sentenced by Judge Merchan. Alan Weisselberg, a 75-year-old, pleaded guilty in August to 15 counts of tax fraud in a deal in which he agreed to testify at the criminal trial of his former employer's company. Susan Neschels, one of the defense lawyers of Trump Organization, said the company plans to appeal. No one else was charged or faces jail time in this case. New York District Attorney Alvin Bragg's office brought the case to court. He's still conducting a criminal investigation into Donald Trump's business practices. Alvin Bragg said in a statement, while corporations can't serve jail time, this consequential conviction and sentencing serves as a reminder to corporations and to executives that you cannot defraud tax authorities and get away with it. Alan Weisselberg's testimony how prosecutors gained the December 6 conviction of the Trump Organization and sister firm Trump Payroll Corporation on 17 similar fraud and tax evasion charges. The Trump Organization was found guilty on all 9 counts, marking the first time it had ever been convicted of crimes. Jurors agreed with prosecutors that the organization, currently run by Donald Trump's two adult sons, Donald Jr. and Eric Trump, ran a years-long scheme to defraud and evade taxes by falsifying business records and hid compensation it paid to top executives between 2005 and 2021. Alan Weisselberg had already pleaded guilty to 15 counts of tax fraud and admitted that he schemed with the company to receive undeclared benefits such as an apartment in a posh Manhattan neighborhood. Britain's Financial Times newspaper has also covered the same story. The government had asked the judge to impose the maximum penalty of $1.61 million, arguing that the Trump Organization had engaged in a multidimensional scheme to defraud taxpayers. Assistant District Attorney Joshua Steinglass told the court at a sentencing hearing on Friday, 10th of January, The sheer magnitude of this fraud merits the largest financial sanction auctioned by the law, describing it as a pervasive culture of fraud at the former president's business. Before imposing the sentence, Judge Juan Manuel Merchan noted that the Trump Organization once again distances the corporation from the acts of the other individuals, adding that although these were arguments that were made throughout the trial, it is not what the evidence has shown, and is certainly not what the jury found. The sentencing of the Trump Organization came just a few days after the same judge sent Alan Weisselberg, the former chief financial officer at the company, to jail for 5 months. Alan Weisselberg, who was a key witness in the trial against his employer, pleaded guilty to committing tax fraud back in August. By accepting $1.8 million in off-the-books perks over the course of 15 years. His crimes carried a maximum sentence of approximately 15 years in prison, but prosecutors agreed to recommend a much more lenient sentence, and about $2 million in financial penalties if Weisselberg testified truthfully in the Manhattan District Attorney's case against the Trump Organization. While on the stand, the 75-year-old Weisselberg said he had acted out of personal greed and did not directly implicate the former president, Donald Trump. However, he said his payroll arrangements did benefit the Trump Organization, which paid less tax as a result. Speaking outside the courtroom, the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, told reporters that while the conviction was consequential, the sentence fell far short of what his office would have liked. Alvin Bragg, who inherited the case from his predecessor Cyrus Vance, said, "I want to be very clear, we don't think that this is enough. Our laws in this state need to change." While the penalties imposed on the Trump Organization are relatively small for a business of its size, the company could now face difficulties in getting loans or working directly with local or federal government entities. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story. The Trump Organization also faces a separate civil case brought by the New York Attorney General Letitia James, who charged the company, as well as Donald Trump and his older children themselves, with inflating the value of its core assets. A judge in that case installed a monitor in November to ensure the business did not attempt to move funds out of the state's jurisdiction while the case is pending. Letitia James is suing Donald Trump and the Trump Organization, charging they misled banks and others about the value of its many assets, including golf courses and skyscrapers. Letitia James, a Democrat, is asking a court to ban Donald Trump and his three eldest children from running any New York-based company and is seeking to fine them at least $250 million. A judge has set an October trial date and appointed a monitor for the company while the case is pending. Donald Trump faces several other legal challenges as he ramps up his presidential campaign. Also on Friday, 10th of January, a judge in a civil case in New York denied Donald Trump's motion to dismiss writer E. Jean Carroll's lawsuit against him in Manhattan federal court. E. Jean Carroll has charged Donald Trump sexually assaulted her in Manhattan in the mid-1990s. And has libeled her. As a special grand jury in Atlanta, Georgia, has investigated whether Trump and his allies committed any crimes while trying to overturn his 2020 election loss in Georgia. Recently, the House January 6 committee voted to make a criminal referral to the Justice Department for Donald Trump's role in sparking the violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January 2021. The FBI is also investigating Donald Trump's storage of classified documents. During last year's Trump Organization trial, Assistant District Attorney Joshua Steinglass told jurors that Trump himself had a role in the fraud scheme, showing them a lease that the Republican signed himself for Alan Weisselberg's perk apartment that was kept off the tax books.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The filter attached to a dialysis machine is not a weapon. It is not a detonator for a bomb or any device that would be deemed dangerous. It is used to cleanse the blood of patients suffering from chronic kidney disease. So why is this life-saving equipment being blocked from entering Yemen? We attended a press conference held by Yemen's Ministry of Health in Sana'a, where it was declared that the Saudi-imposed blockade is causing a national health crisis by preventing entry of medicines and equipment for kidney failure patients. In the absence of dialysis treatment, approximately 5,000 patients on dialysis are at risk of dying, according to the health ministry.
The Saudi-led coalition targeted the health and medical sector from the very beginning of the war by directly destroying medical facilities, centers, hospitals, and medicine warehouses, and by imposing a blockade on every aspect of life through this siege that is being backed by America in order to control the country's health system.
Kaid Ahmed is one of the patients on dialysis, who is currently getting treatment at Athoda Hospital. He said the lack of supplies has prevented him and other patients from receiving the required number of dialysis treatments per week.
We cannot eat much because we are only receiving two dialysis treatments a week instead of the required three treatments. As a result, we can only eat a bare minimum food.
But getting the required three treatments per week for Gayed and the other 5,000 patients like him is a near impossible task these days. This mixed solution, which is used to operate the dialysis machine, is in very short supply. There's only enough for two more weeks.
It's gotten so bad that we have to close down this section simply because we do not have enough supplies to run all of the dialysis machines. If we open this section, we would have no more supplies to treat patients. We've had to make emergency requests to other dialysis clinics to provide us with such equipment. By the end of January, we will be forced to close down because we'll have no more supplies to operate.
Unless the kidney disease center at Athoda Hospital is supplied with dialysis filters and the solution needed to operate dialysis machines, they will be forced to shut down by the end of January. If that happens, the lives of approximately 5,000 patients will be at risk. The Yemeni army has repeatedly warned that if the Saudi-imposed blockade is not lifted, it would be forced to take military action. The siege must be ended so that much-needed medicine and other essential supplies can enter the country. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Stockholm's government has just taken over the rotating presidency of the European Union. It holds the position for the next 6 months and faces many challenges. Amid the conflict in Ukraine, the powers that be in Moscow have been singled out.
This is the peaceful order that the Putin regime now seeks to destroy. But we will defend it here